Blog Talk Radio.
The sky was falling, it streaked with blood. I heard you calling me, then you disappeared into the dust. Upstairs, into the fire. Upstairs, into the fire. I need your key. Love and duty called you someplace high, somewhere upstairs. Into the fire. May your strength give us strength. May your faith give us faith. May your hope give us hope. May your love give us love. May your strength give us strength. May your faith give us faith. May your hope give us hope. May your love give us love.
Lieutenant, I was down on B1. The shafts there are buckling. There's going to be people trapped in those elevators.
Jeez. Just took us an hour to get up to 30 in Tower 1. I didn't want us over in 2.
What happened in 2?
I don't know.
You guys be careful, okay?
Yeah, stay safe.
A1, what's your location?
This is A1. We're in the concourse. We got gear and are heading to 1.
A1, 800, negative that.
Rendezvous with me out on Barclay Street. I got a team here.
We'll all go up together.
8-1, there's something going on with Tower 2.
September 11 was supposed to be a fairly quiet day for me.
We have something that has happened here at the World Trade Center. We noticed flame and an awful lot of smoke from one of the towers of the World Trade Center. My heavens, this is just happened.
Smoke is pouring out. This gas goes from one side of the building practically all the way to the other.
A mother described to me talking to her son on the telephone when the second plane hit. And that's the last time she talked to him. Another family described to me how their loved one had let 2 elevators go because he was older and people in the elevator were younger. And somehow my mind went back to the stories and the things about the Titanic or, you know, people who allowed other people to get on boats, and they didn't get on the boat because they were older. And from that moment on, I started thinking that we'll never know all the heroes. We know our uniform people were heroes. They went there, and they died, and they gave up their lives bravely trying to save the lives of other people. But what we don't know are all the individual stories of the person who gave up the elevator for another person, the person who calmed someone and got them out of the building, the person who organized their floor so that everybody could evacuate, the person who maybe at the last moments comforted people when all of them knew they were going to die.
Anniversary of 9/11, the Movie Geeks Tonight will examine the films that have depicted the events of that horrific day. What has Hollywood and the filmmaking community done right? Where are they lacking, and where have they steered off course with their films depicting 9/11? That's the topic of tonight's show. I am Jamie.
And I'm Jerry, and welcome to our show on a Sunday night. Thank you.
Have you been watching coverage today of the memorial stuff?
Some of it. I think a lot of it's rather pornographic almost. This is a day that's very personal for a lot of people. I have one of my best friends, her son, joined the Marines because of this. And he's in Afghanistan. I think he's now back. He's back in country, but his message, I'll never forget, she told me this, was like, I'm going to join because I never want this to happen ever again in this country.
Right.
So, I think some of it's good. Obviously, this thing yesterday at United, in the Flight 93 is good. But I think this is the problem with the news. It's just constant. I think it almost trivializes it in some ways. Some of it.
Yeah, I did watch, I turned it on C-SPAN. And, C-SPAN is like, they don't censor anything. They show everything. They don't cut to montages or reporters or anything. So you get the complete unfiltered, which sometimes, like congressional hearings and so forth, it can be boring as hell.
Right. No, of course.
But I was watching the New York City, the memorial
right
today. Mm-hmm. And, it lasted hours and hours this morning, and they were naming the names of all the victims.
Right.
And I felt the need to sit through all of them. Like if I was going to hear some of them, I need to hear all of them,
appreciate
the totality, Also, another thing that comes to mind is how people gather around the television to it's kind of a shared experience. I mean, obviously, different households, but there's some kind of, comfort, but like a shared experience where others are gathered. I mean, it was the same thing on the day of 9/11.
Yeah, I think
where
on
we
the
could
day,
see that.
That was the that was very true on the day of.
Same thing with Kennedy, mm-hmm. and probably the radio. I mean, everybody was and the TV. Everybody was tuned into both of those mediums.
Right.
Kind of get a sense at the same time of what was happening. Let's bring on Dean. We're going to talk about the films of 9/11 in this first section of our show, the major section, and then we'll talk about some movie news at the end because we haven't talked about movie news in a couple of weeks. We've had time off and theme shows. So let's bring on Dean. Dino.
Hey.
Hey.
Hey,
Mr. Treadway. Welcome.
Yeah. Hey.
Well, I want to call you Dino. I just think of Dean Martin, so I...
That's why I call him Dino, the ultimate cool cat,
He's cooler than
Dean. That's who I was named after.
Well, that's fitting. I always picture you like sitting near a fire with a glass of scotch in your hand. That's how I picture you.
Actually, two scotches in one of each hand. All right. But enough of that.
Anyway.
Let's get to the heart of the matter here.
Right. Now, there have been a lot. First of all, I guess the way to start would be to ask what everyone asks when you talk about 9/11, which is where you guys were. Dean, were you actually in New York City then?
No, I wasn't, actually. I'm kind of glad that I wasn't, because it would have traumatized me quite a bit. I was in Atlanta, and strangely enough, I was awake early in the morning. But I had woken up and had started a movie, which was actually Mother Jugs and Speed, which is, strangely enough, a comedy about ambulance drivers. And I had just started it, and my mom called me up and let me know what was going on. And, of course, you know.
Where was your mother?
She was at home. She's kind of my guess is that she probably hadn't gone to sleep because she's kind of a late night person like myself. So, of course, completely changed everything. And then later on that night,
did you just stick by the TV all day? And
I did. And then later on that night, I went down to there's a local bar here called Manuel's Tavern, which is very political. A lot of political people there. A lot of journalists and so forth. And I went down there and sort of commiserated with everybody. And then, as I was going down there, I actually ran into some people and I actually sort of like crumpled down into tears, And they
How could you not?
So, yeah.
I was like, I was working, I was managing movie theaters at the time, so I'd had a late night Monday closing, and I was off that Tuesday, and my girlfriend at the time woke me up with a phone call like about 11 o'clock, so a couple hours after it occurred, and started describing what was going on. I said, "Do you know what's going on? The planes hitting and everything else, and a bomb exploding, and because there are all these conflicting reports." And I said, "No." I just said, "It's this terrorism." And she said, "They think it might be." So then I turned on the TV and I was glued all day. But I was house sitting for my parents. They were internationally. They were in Berlin that day, and so I was in this big, you know, lonely, quiet house by myself, watching the stuff all day. And then my good friend came over that night and picked me up, and we went to Steak and Shake. And I remembered vividly, like in the car, listening to NPR or something, and they were playing like the audio cassettes of the Flight 93 calling their loved ones. And I just, that's when I broke down.
Oh yeah.
In the car then. And my parents never called me to tell me they were okay. I was like, you know, if I would stay out past midnight, you'd get upset if I didn't call you. This is an international terrorist incident. Mm-hmm. You know, people overseas, they said, "Be careful, Americans, if you're overseas." I mean, they didn't know. And you don't call me to tell me you're okay? I mean, I think that's a big deal.
Right.
So I was, and there were Florida connections, obviously, because a lot of them were trained here in Florida.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So it was a creepy, creepy day. Jerry, where were you?
Oh, I was in Bethesda, Maryland. We were taping an FDA meeting, which we did at the company I was working at. And, you know, a guy on the cell phone got a news alert that it just said a small plane had hit the one of the towers. But people just thought it was like, we didn't realize the scope. And then all of a sudden, a couple minutes later, an actual plane hit. And then we realized, oh, we're under attack. Now there's an FDA meeting, a lot of government people, and people are flipping out. They wanted to keep the meeting going, because this is what a woman said this year. If we stop the meeting, the terrorists have won. I was like, oh, really?
She said that there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right,
oh, dear.
Right when it was
dear.
Happening?
Yeah. Oh, you were, this is where we're right outside Washington, D.C. We heard about the Pentagon. We heard about the towers. We heard about, there's other things. A car bomb went off at the State Department. That there's all this misinformation coming in. There was all this stuff. Like I remember vividly, though, there's a car bomb at the State Department, and at the Israeli embassy was under attack. There's all this chaotic shit going on. And then we got home. And I remember I stopped in a mall where I used to work, and it was a ghost town. And it was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Dead. Everything was closed. So I just went home. I would normally have gone to the gym that night, but I didn't. We sat in front of the TV and watched CNN from, I think, 4 o'clock in the evening till about 2 in the morning. And the next day, what really struck me, on my way as an elementary school, every kid was walked by their parents. Every kid.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. I'd never seen anything like that in a very long time.
Yeah, the children of 9/11, I mean, that's a whole other heartbreaking aspect of it. Well, you know, if they witnessed that or saw that or how they made sense of it. One of the first things I saw in 9/11, actually film-wise, and by the way, the intro of the show tonight, the clips from World Trade Center, the Oliver Stone movie, and a documentary on HBO called In Memoriam that Giuliani kind of spearheaded. Those were the two film-related clips in the intro. But one of the first things I saw was something called Telling Nicholas or something. It was the child's mother. He was like 6 or 7. Maybe younger, died in the towers, and somehow there were cameras with them that day as it was happening, all week,
mm-hmm.
where they tried to reach the decision of how to tell the son that his mother wasn't coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about incredibly wrenching. But also, you kind of felt, felt the need to experience the pain in some small measure from those that experienced it firsthand, you know, to
mm-hmm.
you owed it to really understand the consequences of that day. And I think the 9/11 films and documentaries that have been made, the ones that are best, really give you that sense. I mean, they're not, as you say, and you're quite right, they're not pornographic in nature. They're respectful.
right.
But also very respectful in their kind of solemn telling of that day.
Mm-hmm.
But what interested me too was actually, what was the first movie? Was 25th Hour, that was really the first movie that depicted that post 9/11 sensibility,
I mean,
didn't it?
I'd say
really,
so.
I would have to say so, because that's December of 2002, and I think that was the earliest movie I can think of, unless there's something else, but the earliest...
certainly the earliest narrative film.
Yeah.
Right. And what Spike Lee did there, I mean, it was never intended to be a 9/11 film, because
right.
it had been planned prior to that event, but... it was always intended to be a New York film.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's like the book. Yeah, I mean, yeah, the book
yeah.
is so.
And a lot of people consider 25th Hour one of the great New York films.
Mm-hmm.
That and Dog Day Afternoon and, you know, the like. It's a great New York film.
Oh,
but what 25th Hour does, it's about a guy, Edward Norton, who's this drug dealer who's finally going to prison. He's been nabbed, and he's got
mm-hmm.
one last night with his friends before he goes to jail, and he's petrified of going to jail, to prison. And so there's this sense they're in the 9/11 environment in New York. You see the Ground Zero.
Mm-hmm.
There's this sense of loss, of regret, of just anger and disillusionment, and just it's all there, and just
mm-hmm.
deep sorrow. So it's in the character of the movie, almost indefinable. They don't have to be explicit with it. It's there.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, you see Ground Zero, but even when you see
yeah.
Ground Zero, don't you just see it like through a window that he's,
yeah.
that he's
yeah.
He and Philip Seymour Hoffman are standing in front of, and
mm-hmm.
right.
and that's about as close as they get to actually, you know, referring to it, you know,
outside of the opening
directly.
Credits, yeah,
right,
mm-hmm. yeah, outside of the opening credits, of course, yes.
But there's also something of at the end of it, he's asking a favor of his friends to beat the hell out of him, to make him ugly before he
right.
goes to prison,
right.
so he has less of a chance of being screwed with. I just got a sense that that people were in a different place post 9/11. They had been faced with this ugly horror, and they weren't prepared for it. And in a sense, they needed to understand that mentality so they could fight it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean
yeah.
that's a roundabout way of relating the two.
Mm-hmm. It's also mm-hmm. a very common trait in Edward Norton's career and his three great roles up to that point, 25th Hour, American History X, and Fight Club, all very battered, self-abusive characters.
Right.
So, I mean, it's that, but it's also, you could take it that Monty Brogan, the character he plays in 25th Hour, that's really a metaphor. He's a metaphor for America, really, being the bruised, the beaten up, to, you know, I need this so I can survive. It's like, you could look at it that way. I need this so I can survive in prison, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like America itself, to survive, you know. God, you know, we were very so lucky for so long, and so because we had the oceans to protect us and everything, and then this, our own things were turned against us 10
right.
years ago. So,
it's my favorite Spike Lee movie.
I think so. I would have to agree with you.
It was my number one movie of the past decade on the list that we did,
mm-hmm.
you know, in 2000, early this year.
Right.
Or early 2010, is that a part
in
of 2010, that's the new decade.
Yeah, we started January 2010, I believe.
Yeah,
it's
not good at math,
decade,
but either way.
It's definitely a decade-defining movie, mm-hmm. I think, too. Like, it's just, it's kind of grown into something that just says it all
mm-hmm.
about this particular time that we're
yeah.
living in.
It is a time capsule movie. I mean, it's a couple of movies really go outside of the demands of the script and really allow real life to breathe into it and
mm-hmm.
that period of time where they're shooting.
Right.
Where you get a sense of the life of the actual production outside of the script on the page. There are a couple of movies like that. I mean, Apocalypse Now is like that.
Oh, definitely.
I mean, all the problems that they had on that film, all the chaos, that's in the film. You know?
Mm-hmm.
You can feel it. And it's the same thing with 25th Hour. But the first, and a lot of TV stuff too, and there was, I can't bring my switchboard up, so I want to play this clip, but I can't do it. I think it was CBS, they're replaying it again tonight in like a revised 10th anniversary edition. They did a 9/11 documentary, a two-hour documentary, 6 months after 9/11. And it was actually a project where two French brothers
were
shooting a documentary, about a rookie firefighter.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were following him around for months. And in that period of time, 9/11 happened. So they actually went into the tower that was hit first with their cameras. They captured everything.
They're actually the only people that actually captured the plane going, the second plane going into the
tower. That's right. I remember that was a big deal back then.
They're the only ones that got that footage. And I think it was done for ABC, actually, and they ended up winning a few Emmys for
that's CBS.
No,
it's CBS.
CBS.
CBS? Yeah. Okay.
It plays again tonight at 8. But they got the first plane, right?
So they got the first plane. Okay.
Yes. Because they were testing, they were shooting some routine test on the street. They're looking at a pothole or something, and they hear this roar, and then they veer their camera up, and it's quite a movie and quite an emotional movie and a real tribute to the firefighters and first responders and police that were there that day and killed that day.
Yeah.
So I mean, television right out of the gate, they came out with something strong. Did any of you guys see the first miniseries, The Path to 9/11, the Harvey Keitel thing?
No, I never watched that. I never got a chance to see that.
I was warned off by just the political bent of it. So I kind of stayed away from it intentionally.
I know Harvey Keitel wasn't pleased with it.
No, he was. I remember
he
reading
wasn't,
that.
What did he have to say about it?
I think he just thought they went in the wrong direction with it. I don't remember the exact quote, but he expressed his displeasure with the whole thing.
Didn't he do that like before the movie actually aired or something? And that's I think that's the reason that I stayed away from it. Actually, did you watch?
Well, I never saw it. I never really saw any of those made for TV movies. I mean, I'd watch the documentaries and stuff, but I mean, I know Showtime had their Time of Crisis movie where, what's his name, played Bush, the guy played him in the comedy series.
Timothy Bottoms.
I vaguely remember that, okay.
Speaking of Apocalypse Now, Timothy Bottoms played. you know, I could tell that was a big joke just, you know, from the previous of it, so... but movies that actually portrayed the event, because there's countless movies that portray the aftermath and the wars and everything that resulted from it and kind of politicized it. But the actual event, I mean, United 93 was the big one. That was 2006, wasn't it? 2006.
Yeah, that was 2006. And then later on that in the summer, the end of the summer, World Trade Center comes out. So those are the two biggies.
Mm-hmm.
And United 93, that's also one of my favorite movies of the past decade, and I think the best movie ever made about the events of that day. And it was an interesting experience watching it in the theater opening weekend, because nobody really, it was a packed house, and it was just a palpable sense. Nobody wanted to see it, but they felt they had to, they needed this. So we all, you know, 400 of us in this theater, everybody was quiet. Everybody was kind of like shaking, you could tell, and nervous. And at the end, when the passengers fight back, they were standing up and they were cheering. It was this big group event, and we were all feeling the same thing, and it was sad, yes, but it was also cathartic
mm-hmm.
in a way that film was.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
Film was very unique in the way it was made. I mean, Paul Greengrass directed it.
That movie just blows me away. I just have to like speak up about United 93 for a second. The editing, the sound work,
mm-hmm.
the way that the dialogue is portrayed, the way that they have the actual participants. I mean, almost
yeah.
everybody you see on the screen, except for, of course, the people who are, you know, on the plane.
Right.
But almost everybody else that you see on the screen are actually playing themselves, including,
right.
I'm looking up his name right now, including the head of the FCC or whatever. The sort of older guy that's
right.
Trying
I know who you're talking about.
Trying to make sense of it all. That's a really good performance. I mean, and people say, oh, well, you know, he's just playing himself or whatever. You know, it's not quite that way.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
It's not that easy.
Yeah.
It's not that easy.
And you know what? Playing yourself has to be the hardest thing to play.
Yeah.
I would think so. I would definitely think so.
It's an incredible movie.
That's his name. Ben
Sliney. It's told in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a sense of the confusion and the chaos of that day. Obviously, we don't know exactly what everyone said on the flight.
Right, right.
We only know from the communications and the phone calls and such from the flight what was the events that happened on the plane. But, I mean, nothing's enhanced. For you know, nothing's made movie-ish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, this is such a dramatic event. You don't need to movie-fy it,
right?
You know,
yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Well, that's one of the things that was said about the event. It seemed like watching the planes crashing, but it was like something out of it. Everyone kept saying, "A Hollywood movie." That was the analogy that was used over and over again. They felt they were watching something in a Hollywood blockbuster, summer blockbuster. That's. I think that says something right there about our culture and everything and how we perceive things is that we thought, wow, that's what it's like. So, yeah, I always found that to be an interesting answer when people would say that.
United 93 actually was just released on Blu-ray last Tuesday, I believe. So if you haven't seen it yet, here's a trailer to give you a sense of the film.
Which is a very good one.
Dan, actually, conducive to just heading out and enjoying a day.
Hey, this is Sandy in the back. Can you call ground and see if we can get some more pillows and blankets?
The white zone is for immediate...
The meeting last night was great.
I'm sure he's thrilled.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin boarding. For the load of our first class passengers, please make their way over
to
gate 17.
Good morning, sir. You just made it.
4G?
Thanks. Ladies and gentlemen, looks like we've run into a little bit of rush hour traffic this morning. Unfortunately, it's going to be about a 30-minute delay. I appreciate your patience. We're currently number one for departure. Flight attendants, prepare for takeoff, please.
I'd like to be home with my babies.
United 93, runway 4 left, clear for takeoff.
Roger that.
CNN's reporting a light civil aircraft has just hit the World Trade Center.
Man, that's a lot of smoke.
We got another one.
We got another hijack?
United 175 dropped his transponder off.
We got a possible hijack. Weapon. Scramble those fighters in over Manhattan.
Copy that.
We've reached our cruising altitude of 35,000 feet, and I'm going to turn the fastened seatbelt sign off. So you are safe to move about the cabin.
Descending rapidly. The aircraft is going down, I'm telling you right now.
Here's one with juice for you.
No, there he is. There he is. Right there.
We're at the Hudson River.
Yeah, this is a hijack. He's going to hit this guy. Oh,
look at that.
Oh, my gosh.
Two aircraft hit the World Trade Center. Just left north, the weather was beautiful.
We have a plane headed toward the Capitol.
What the hell is wrong out there?
May we engage, sir?
I am on a plane that has been hijacked.
Yes, sir. I got F-16 turning and burning towards Washington.
Two planes just hit the World Trade Center.
We have to get something right now.
Arnold, I need rules of engagement. Do we shoot this flight down?
We have to do it now, because we know what happens if we just sit here and do nothing.
So United 93 is now available. If you haven't seen it and you're willing to see it, it's worthwhile. And I know a lot of people didn't like the idea of a movie being made about the events. It was the whole we're not ready kind of argument. But those that did see it and were ready to, it was entirely rewarding. But that movie will always be there. You know, and that movie's going to survive.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember going to I remember the weekend that it opened. I was in Ohio with some friends of mine, and we always go to see movies. And so I said, well, it wasn't a very good time. It was released in the spring or whatever. So it's not – in spring, you know, usually not a great time for movies. And at a 25, you know, theater multiplex, this was the best thing, most interesting thing that was playing. I tried to get them all to go and see it, and they just couldn't do it. So I ended up watching it on video. And watching it on video was actually, I mean, I can't even imagine what it would have been like watching it in the theater, because even watching it on video, I mean, this is a movie that makes your heart pound out of your chest. Ridiculously puts you right there in it. For me, this is one of the most you know, defining movies of the decade.
No, I agree.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt.
And you know, regardless what you think of the movie, Passion of the Christ, there are two films that I've seen that have had the on opening day that have had the most amazing audience reactions.
Oh yeah,
it was like so palpable.
Yeah, I mean,
United 93 was one, and Passion of the Christ was the other.
I have never been to a movie. Passion of Christ. I went to like the first showing that morning on Ash Wednesday, and I mean everyone was crying. I mean, there was not a draw. I mean, everyone was just weeping at the end of the movie. I've never seen anything like that. It's a fantastic movie going experience, regardless of what you think of the film. There's no denying the power of watching. And it is very powerful.
Well, it was the same palpable sense I got at United 93. Mm-hmm. Like people just bracing themselves when it started, you know, not wanting to lose it. Even watching the previews in the theaters, and you heard this like collective sigh when they first said United 93 of the trailer. Like, oh God, I don't know if I could do that. And some people were upset that they did it to begin with. But and you're right, Jerry. A couple of months later, August, I think, World Trade Center came out. Oliver Stone. Now you had one movie in mind.
Yeah.
What kind of 9/11 movie in mind that would come from somebody like Oliver Stone?
He didn't get that. He threw us all for a loop with this one. I mean,
When Sean Hannity comes out and starts to brag about the new Oliver Stone movie, you know it's not what you
expect.
It's
a different movie. And it was a sign of things to come with, I think, with Oliver Stone. He definitely, I mean, with W as well, he definitely defeated anyone's expectations of what he was going to do. But World Trade Center is an interesting film. It's not what you think, but it owes a lot, I think, in one sense, to the Rescue Me, which had started 2 years before that, but not as clever and not as good. But it does owe something to that series that just concluded last week. But World Trade Center, it starts off with a lot of momentum, and then it gets lost. I think it does.
Well, it starts on such a grand scale, and you don't. I didn't expect it to recreate that story like in full frontal. You know, it recreated the towers and the scene on the streets that day and everything, and it was odd seeing a recreation of it when you'd seen the real thing.
Yeah,
and that was so fresh in your mind. It really was, and it was odd, the CGI towers. You know, when they were rising, when they hadn't been hit yet, and you saw them CGI'd. It's just an odd kind of disembodied feel to it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then it shifts gears into something a lot more intimate when it's just the two Port Authority workers trapped underneath the rubble, trying to survive and keep each other alive before they're saved. I mean, I think the movie's good, and I think it's very respectful. I don't have a problem with it existing. The only thing that I have a problem with is that Oliver Stone did. This isn't like an Oliver Stone movie to me. I've always said, this is a Ron Howard movie. This is not an Oliver Stone movie.
I agree.
Do you think he's mellowed then? Do you just think that Oliver mellowed with this?
Gordon Gekko's a good guy, and he's mellowed.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing this whole trend of... almost like this very Coppola-esque trend, Michael Corleone seeking redemption, Gordon Gekko's a good guy, you know, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, he definitely has mellowed with age, although, you know, you might make a case that looking at his documentaries on, Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro, that maybe he hasn't mellowed with age, or so.
Well,
you know,
I think that's a medium where he's shown the old Oliver Stone again, and his new Showtime miniseries, The Secret History of America, I think.
That's right. That's coming.
But the bad thing is, he doesn't consider himself a documentary filmmaker. But he actually could make waves by pursuing that from now on, because he ain't doing it with his narrative features.
No, I think that era is over.
I also wonder if the bad again is because, you know, maybe there might be some forces in the executive offices that might not want to bankroll anything that he does that might be too controversial.
Maybe. But there's also the fact that he's older and he says, you know, it's time to pass the baton. I mean, I've taken my share of hits over this kind of stuff, and you know, I've done my duty, I've done my time.
Right.
You know, let the youth take it over.
Yes.
Also, somebody brought up in the chat room something interesting, and this harkens back to my theater days when 9/11 occurred, and I remember going back to movie theater. I had the opening morning shift on the following Wednesday morning. It was so quiet, like nobody was saying anything, and when we opened the theater, I noticed there was a Muslim man, and he was sitting outside of a theater waiting for it to start to go into the theater. He was sitting out there in the open, and I could see the look on his face, a look of, you know, I'm not going to let this scare me or debilitate my life. I'm going out today, like this day, in a public place, you know, and I thought that was incredibly brave. I looked at him, and I felt a sense of, like, courage from him and a sense of, you know, sadness in a way. But there was also dictates from the studios to the theaters to pull certain things from the theaters.
That's right.
There was a Spider-Man trailer and a Spider-Man poster. The first Spider-Man, the trailer depicted, like, this bank robbery going on. It wasn't in the movie. And Spider-Man catches them in the helicopter and in his web that he connects between the two towers. So the helicopter's like floating between the two towers in this big web. That was pulled, as well as the poster that showed Spider-Man and the reflection of the Twin Towers in his eye. A couple other things were pulled. Movies were pulled.
Don't Say a Word was pulled, I think. And then Training Day, didn't they want to postpone that for a little while?
Yeah. Yeah, they postponed this Pacino movie, this People I Know movie, because it had a shot at the end of the World Trade Center. I mean, really, like, movies and their decisions to pretend like, almost like the Twin Towers did not exist.
Well, they wanted to go back and digitally erase them out of some movies. I remember they wanted, it was just I mean it was the wrong. It was actually a precursor of like the just these oversensitive overreactions. I mean, you shouldn't make like they don't.
They never existed.
That was just a boneheaded move by a lot of people, I thought.
It would be kind of weird in your summer blockbuster Spider-Man, though, to see the Trade Center pop up. But I think that scene was shot for the trailer. I don't think they ever intended to put it actually in the film. I think it was a standalone for the trailer, if I understand.
As it is, I think the last narrative movie to actually include the Twin Towers in its Nissan Finn or whatever is AI, artificial intelligence, which actually even, you know, in the epilogue to the movie, when the aliens come down and the world is frozen over, you can still see the Twin Towers, you know, sticking up out of the ice.
That was the summer before it happened. That was released the summer.
But
before.
what about the one that James Franco, Robert De Niro movie, City by the Sea? Was that in New York or?
Yeah, I'm sure. Okay, I'm sure it was. I mean, you can't if you shoot the skyline at all in those pre 9/11. But the first movie post 9/11, there are two movies that actually showed the Twin Towers, and those movies were Gangs of New York and Munich, and both of them occurred in the very last shots of those movies, I think.
I was going to mention the shot in Munich, which I
find it's a famous, infamous shot.
That's a great little commentary and an underrated movie.
Oh, it's underrated. Very underrated.
Collateral Damage was delayed.
It should have been delayed. Period. Indefinitely.
It should still be delayed.
Yeah.
What you delay my movie for?
Have him call in and talk about that.
Right.
And then Nicholas Vargo also says that Big Trouble was delayed until April.
That's right. And
it
hurt that
movie.
A good funny movie, but that delay, they delayed it until April and everyone forgot about it. But
you know what I do recall, though, that they stuck with the release, I think, of Zoolander.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did.
Which was like the week after or something, the following week or something it came out.
I think.
And that was such a tonic. I mean, because Zoolander is as goofy funny as you can get. I mean, it's stupid funny to the max. And people thought it was even funnier because they needed to laugh together in the theater. I mean,
Definitely.
It was great. I mean, it was great that they did that. And actually, the shot showing the silhouette of the plane as it flies into the tower in World Trade Center, when you just hear it and then you see the silhouette of the plane flying by, it flies over the poster of Zoolander in Oliver Stone's movie, if you remember.
Right, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so I don't know if that was like unintended laughs coming from theater in that moment. But yeah, that was good. And you know, I always connect those two, 9/11 and Zoolander, which is really, really odd because Zoolander is as far removed from that as you want to get, and that was the point.
I think it served a great purpose there, you know. Really cathartic, you know, purpose after something like this. So
yeah.
We should also talk about War of the Worlds.
Right.
Yeah. Definitely one of the best like post 9/11 movies. I mean, he really captured that feeling, that dread, that uneasiness. I think the first half, I mean, I like the whole movie, but the first half especially, he really captured it very well. I can't disagree with anything in that film in regards to that.
That's the one thing he did best in that movie, actually. I mean, right down from like. Obviously, the haunting stuff, the haunting images of like the freight train that's on fire,
right?
And obviously, the masses of people getting incinerated and dust and everything. I mean, it's unmistakable.
And then Tim Robbins enters the movie and slows everything down completely.
right? Yeah. But you know, and I think a lot of movies they attribute it to 9/11 that aren't deserving or it's really reaching to say this is what the post 9/11 movie would look like.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those disaster movies fit that bill because, I mean, whatever that movie is, 2012, that would have been the same movie had they had that technology in the 70s when they were doing
mm-hmm.
Airport and all that other stuff.
It's true.
You know, I don't think that's necessarily informed by 9/11. It's just a way to give more weight to something that doesn't deserve it.
Right.
Know? So there's countless movies like that that they say, oh, this is inspired by 9/11 and reflects the different world we live in. No, not really.
Now, those movies, even The Day After Tomorrow, those movies would have been made, I think, regardless of 9/11 or not. I think something
yeah.
like The Happening, though, where M. Night is so late to the game, but he's definitely trying to catch in on that. And let's not forget Danny Boyle's the first zombie movie, sort of, you know, definitely got a lot of these movies, a lot of the zombie movies, though, of that in the post era, sort of do reflect an anxiety about 9/11. And some of them will hit you over the head repeatedly with its subtext, like George Romero. But
yeah.
But I think the first 28 days later, if not 28 weeks later, but definitely 28 weeks later, definitely even does it more. But I think that Danny Boyle was trying to go for something then with that.
There's also another movie that a lot of listeners, maybe even you guys, might not know of. It comes from a Belgian. Well, I think I think she's an American filmmaker, but it was financed by Belgium. But it's a movie called from 2006 called Day Night, Day Night,
uh-huh.
and the filmmaker is called it's named Julia Lakev.
Mm-hmm.
Her second movie is actually, this was her debut film. Her second movie is actually featured in the upcoming New York Film Festival.
Right.
But it's about a 19-year-old Middle Eastern girl who is American Middle Eastern girl who is who has been chosen to be a suicide bomber in Times Square. And the entire movie takes place over the day before she is set to go into Times Square to set the bomb off, and it follows her very tensely, just walking through crowds and you know, enjoying her last meals and things like that, and it's a very, very tense and brilliant movie. I think one of the
yeah.
great movies of 2006.
I never saw the anthology movie, and I think it's 9/11/01
mm-hmm.
is what it's called. And I know Sean Penn directed one of the segments, and Ernest Borgnine was his star in it. It was
mm-hmm.
just these world directors. It was like an anthology of something like 7 or 8
short films.
I never did get a chance to see that.
Also, Adam Sandler movie.
Rain Over Me.
Me.
That's another one that's a good post 9/11. I actually think that's a horribly underrated film.
It was too deafening hearing Adam Sandler apologize for those kinds of movies. That
yeah, I mean,
I never got to see it.
So now we get Jack and Jill.
I'm sorry. I'll go back and I'll do another Happy Gilmore. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I lost my head.
I really like Adam Sandler when he goes outside of, you know, his normal genre, and I think that Rain Over Me is a very, very underrated movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
very emotional.
Don Cheadle in it, right?
Yeah, he's wonderful in it too.
Yeah, it's a very good movie. Mm-hmm.
And there's obviously the documentaries that were made, the most famous of which, I mean, I don't want to talk about the political movies or the movies about the war and stuff
right,
so much.
Right, no,
but,
I understand.
But, I mean, the elephant in the room is Fahrenheit 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I've been reading Michael Moore's new autobiography, and the whole first 50 or so pages deals with this story. When he... Bowling for Columbine, actually, is my favorite Michael Moore
mm-hmm.
movie. And the section, the little, like, 3-minute section on 9/11 there is as haunting to me as anything in Fahrenheit 9/11. When he accepted the Oscar for that, it's interesting. And he made that speech, and everybody kind of hated him for it afterwards, because he made the speech when we were 4 days into the new war, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of support for the war then, and a lot of boos from the audience. I think like Scorsese and Meryl Streep were trying to cheer him on, and Harrison Ford was sitting there laughing.
Right, right.
But a lot of people were booing. But he said something interesting, what I didn't know. When Oscar winners walk backstage, like when they're carted off the stage, backstage, the first thing they're given is a glass of champagne by one person and a breath mint from another.
Oh.
And he said, I had a bonus. I had a third person walk up to me and scream in my ear, asshole.
Right, right. Oh, my God.
And he had, nobody would talk to him at the party, so he left. And he flew back home, and the Homeland Security people were giving him a hard time, and they like scraped his Oscar like on purpose with their keys.
Right, right, yeah.
He went home. There was like tons of manure, horse manure, on his front porch, so he mm-hmm. couldn't go into his house. He had to hire 9 SEALs to protect him because of all the death threats against him.
Right.
And people tried to approach him and slice him. And several times, and the Secret Service would come in and stop them.
Right.
Wow.
So they were able to do so. Yeah, it's interesting, the aftermath of that. But at that point, he said, screw it, I'm not hiding. Let's make the last documentary we'll ever make. And that's how Fahrenheit 9/11 came out. The problem for me with Michael Moore is I think he's a great filmmaker in that he makes films that are emotional and that involve you in a human level. My problem with him is how loosey-goosey he is with the facts. And, you know, and when somebody calls him on it, he says, okay, fine, that's wrong, but what about all this stuff? I'm like, no,
yeah.
I mean, if you're making a documentary based on what you think are facts, if one part of it is faulty, you know, the whole thing kind of, you know, swaggers underneath
mm-hmm.
it.
I think
I think he gets to the truth, the essence of the truth, without actually telling the truth completely. You know, it's a weird
been
thing.
Better off using, instead of the guy who wrote House of Bush, House of Saud, I think he would have been better off using Kevin Phillips, who was a hardcore Republican and then sort of jumped the fence and wrote a series of books, American Dynasty about the Bushes, and then American Theocracy. He would have been better had he interviewed Kevin Phillips. I think it would have given him the film some real lasting street cred. Because by interviewing this other guy, that guy's facts for that book at the time were put into dispute by a lot of people. And I think I was really surprised he used him, because he's prominently interviewed, and I think we need to get rid of Herma123 in the chat room.
For sure.
He's gone.
Good. All right. I haven't been in the chat room that much, but that's what I just saw when I got in there. But it's a very emotional, it's a very powerful film. But if you, like you said, it's the facts that he just doesn't get right sometimes. And
you know what? I mean,
in the factuality department.
Well, he's really an essayist making movies. You know, that's the thing is,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's an essayist. He doesn't hide his own, obviously doesn't hide his own political views on things. And you're right about him fudging. Everything you said about him fudging the facts and stuff is completely correct. But he does get to the heart of things.
Mm-hmm.
But my biggest problem with Michael Moore is, I think, just comes with, you know, going to see a Michael Moore movie, which is his insertion of himself so much into the movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's
the grandstanding.
Okay, it's the grandstanding.
Do you remember a couple years ago? Manufacturing Descent came out, which was about him, made by liberal Canadian filmmakers, and they
mm-hmm.
interviewed a lot of documentarians. And the one thing that a lot of other documentarians have, besides being jealous of him, they all say that he has broken the cardinal rule by putting himself in the film. This is
mm-hmm.
a common thing you hear, a common criticism. And while at a base level I can see, oh, it's bad, that's kind of one of the reasons we like about Michael Moore, because he does break rules, and you need that.
You know, and it's not necessarily a rule that he's broken.
Yeah.
And because Werner Herzog puts himself in a lot of
trouble.
Oh, yeah, he used
Herzog. I mean, yeah, he's all over the place.
Nick Broomfield, too, is another one who did, you know, Kurt and Courtney and so forth.
And there's another one with the facts. That's another guy that has a lot of trouble with the facts. Every film he does, there's a lot of controversy about him.
Well, what's notable about Fahrenheit 9/11, and which probably speaks to how useful it was, like how much people needed to see something like that at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It's the highest grossing documentary ever.
Right.
I mean, the first one to break $100 million. And when they polled people, and the Bush administration did this, they polled people to see what kind of impact the movie had on their chances for reelection. It came in the top three reasons why people would not vote for him again, which was the movie. And so it did become like a major movement. And I remember walking out of that theater opening night, another movie I saw opening night, and I mean the cops were hauling people away for making disturbances because they were confronting people outside of the theater, saying you deserve to know the truth, don't believe those lies and that kind of stuff. And actually, I mean, I walked away from the movie. It didn't really tell me much I didn't already know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I didn't buy it, all of it wholeheartedly, because I knew the source of it, but I thought it was an extremely well-made film, and the part that hit me was the mother of the deceased soldier.
Right.
I mean, that was the human part,
yeah.
And really, beyond all the twisted facts or whatever he presented, that was the most effective point of his movie, that little section.
Right. I agree with that.
Right.
And the flip side of Fahrenheit is no end in sight, which is a very academic breakdown of the ensuing war after 9/11. You know, it's not emotional; it's talking heads. And so, if you want that kind of movie, I mean, they're there. Those movies.
Mm-hmm.
Again, like that filmmaker who later won the Oscar for Inside Job is a very mathematical kind of filmmaker. In fact, he's a doctor of mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can see in both of those movies, you know, him trying to add up things almost, you know.
Yeah.
We talked to him,
Charles Ferguson, about Inside Job, which was his new movie, and the No One in Sight filmmaker you're talking about, right?
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, he definitely has it. And Inside Job is a lot more of a kind of a impassioned, confrontational movie than No End in Sight, as I remember.
Mm-hmm.
We should also mention, you know, the Truther movement, and there's been a couple of documentaries that whether you want to believe in any of that stuff or not, which I don't necessarily, but it does bring up like certain questions that I have about the whole everything that happened that day.
Stuff like Loose Change. Is
Loose
that what
Change
to
be the most
loose change.
One.
Yes. Loose Change, and Dylan Avery's Loose Change, and also maybe even Alex Jones's Endgame.
Well, he has a lot. Alex Jones has so many on InfoWars and Prison, all of his sites. I mean, that guy's like the Fassbinder of documentaries, or conspiracy theory documentaries. I mean, he's cranking those things out. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, he's got a lot. Whether you agree with him or not, the guy is prolific.
Yeah. They're interesting movies, you know. It's just interesting to see, some people who still have questions, you know, about, because, you know, I mean, the biggest question that I have about 9/11 is why did some of the buildings fall that had no damage, very little damage at all, including World Trade Center number 7. That's probably the biggest.
I remember that last
question
year.
That I have.
People wanted to know that for years. Let me ask you this, though, Dean, because you brought up Dylan Avery, who did Loose Change. What has become of him? I have not seen his name mentioned as much in the last couple of years as, like, at least, you know, it seems that he's disappeared.
It just seems that he keeps recutting the movie. you know, I mean, there's there's numerous different versions of loose change. There's the original loose change, and then there's a second edition that came out.
Oh, yeah,
he's the George Lucas of documentary filmmakers.
He just keeps going and recutting it. So he's just kind of like this one subject filmmaker. So what's become of him? I don't know. I don't know anything really else about him other than this film. So, I don't know. He's going to have to find another subject sooner or later.
Well, I remember the article in Vanity Fair when he became very popular on the fringe, beyond the fringe culture, he had actually become very popular. And there were movie deals and everything lined up and everything, and I guess they evaporated.
Yeah.
Well, somebody in the chat room, Jerry, you mentioned this earlier, Rescue Me. That's the major television.
Yeah.
Illumination of 9/11, post 9/11. Do you think that the ending of I hate to mention this movie in the company of these others, but do you think the ending of Remember Me is disrespectful?
Oh God, is it? Because they're when you realize where he is, it's just seems. I'm not, and this is no offense to the star of the movie because of Twilight or anything, because I actually thought he was very good in Water for Elephants, so that's not that. It just seems like a really cheesy cash-in. I don't know if disrespectful, I just think, we really want to do this right now? This is how you
the movie's not the movie's not deserving of that payoff.
Yeah, it doesn't. There's not enough emotional. There should be more emotional investment than there is, but there really isn't. And to have it end like that, you're just like, wow. It actually takes you out of the movie, I think, completely.
Yeah.
It really does.
I did see that movie, yeah. And I mean, the point.
I haven't seen it, but I don't plan to watch it. But
missing much. I mean, it's a minor movie, and it's not much to get upset about. But the point of the movie is kind of, the whole thing of cherish what you have and every day and the people that love you and blah, 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 and the way that they really tried to draw that home in the most visceral way at the end was to show the lead character in the World Trade Center building on that day.
Mm-hmm.
So you knew that it was his day had ended. His life had ended.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It didn't belong there. It's like putting, it's like ending Sweet Home Alabama with Pearl Harbor. Yeah, it doesn't.
Actually, that's an interesting idea, Jamie.
That would be a good mix-up, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah. Let's mix up 2 weeks' notice with Tora, Tora, Tora.
Yeah.
That would be good.
Just to let you guys know, today on Hulu, I was watching. I watched about an hour of it before the show. I watched a film that's available on Hulu to see for free called Saint of 9/11.
Okay.
And it's about Father Michael Judge, the fire chaplain who was killed that day while
first reported death.
Yeah, exactly. And was killed while giving last rites to someone. That's a very, from what I've seen of it so far, it's by Glenn Holston, and it's quite a moving film, I have to say. It was very interesting.
And an interesting guy.
For sure.
There's also, I forget if it's History Channel or Nat Geo, it's whoever ran the other week the only interview with George Bush about that day. What channel was that? It was an hour conversation with Bush, and he went through that day, and that was the only interview he granted for that. But they have lots of 9/11 programming that they've been playing. And in terms of, TV kind of documentaries, those are the best that I've seen, and it's amazing how they've retraced the steps of the terrorists every step that day, what hotel they stayed at, what ATM they visited, the conversation they had with the ticket counter guy. Mm-hmm. They put the ticket counter guy on to talk about it, the stories of the survivors, and I thought this was urban legend, but they interviewed the guy that wrote it down. That was in a higher floor and rode the rubble down and survived.
Wow.
Yeah. Amazing. I thought that was just like one of those, you know, urban legends that popped up after that, but
mm-hmm. True. Yeah, I definitely see that. Wow.
One of the most interesting TV docs that I've seen, we should talk about this. I don't know who first put it on, but it's an hour-long TV doc called The Falling Man, and it's all about the photograph that was taken of the man falling to his death. It's quite a beautiful photograph, but also shocking and horrifying, and trying to determine in that documentary who exactly that man was. And that's quite a moving piece as well.
Yeah. And it's really, I remember Spielberg being interviewed like soon after 9/11, and he said, they asked him, will Hollywood do a movie like this? And he said, no, I don't think it should happen. I mean, I don't think you should make the real-life disaster film of that day. And we still haven't had an all-encompassing movie about that day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there have been snapshots of certain moments in certain locations, but you haven't had like a JFK-style movie on that day about that day. Do you think that we will eventually?
Is it necessary? Is it necessary because it was all televised in one sense? It's not obviously what you would call the melodrama of what was, but it's in one sense no narrative film is going
right.
to be able to recreate. I don't know how to really phrase this any better than what we witnessed. And what people witnessed in New York, and especially near the Pentagon, and I just don't know if it's necessary because it's one of these events that was documented live as it was happening.
I get exactly what you're saying, and that's exactly Spielberg's argument. But
yeah.
I know that no film is necessarily.
Mm-hmm. True. True. To an extent, yeah.
And I know that, you know, whether it's necessary or not. I mean, if they were inclined to make it, they would.
Mm-hmm.
If they would make that kind of movie, who would you entrust it to?
Hmm.
Oh, God.
Boy, I mean, you know, it just seems like, you know, I'm just flashing back to Paul Greengrass, you know, but he would never want to, like, revisit it. But 1993 does it just so right that if you're going to do it any other way, I mean, like, it just seems like too big of a subject matter, first of all, to, like, contain in even a four-hour movie, you know. So I don't see how they could do it unless, you know, I mean, they would only be – any kind of movie that takes place that's about history, it's really – or any kind of biopic or anything like that. It's really better if you just take a little sliver of what happened and dramatize that, and that's what's interesting about United 93 and what makes it probably the definitive movie about that day, because it takes a sliver of what happened and shows you everything connected to that sliver. But you know, I just don't think that you could make a movie about it and contain it in any kind of movie kind of shape.
You would have to do an AMC or FX or HBO style series to really, because I think if you did, in all seriousness though, if you did a miniseries obviously, but if you did it as a narrative film, I can just see the criticism. You didn't include this, you included this, why did you do this? You know, you can just, and I'm not saying that's not a reason to do it, because if we did that, nothing would ever get done. But I don't know how the day itself, I don't know how you contain that in 2 to 3 hours.
Right.
I really don't know.
I just don't think you could do it. That said, you know, a name flashed into my mind, if it was going to be done as a series, it might be interesting to see somebody like David Chase or David Simon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, who's the ultimate New York director? I mean, especially now that Sidney Lumet has died.
you would want Spike Lee. I mean, Spike Lee or Woody Allen.
Well, what?
And I don't know if Woody, you see Woody Allen's now, but he is definitely the ultimate New York. But I mean, I don't want Woody Allen doing that. But I mean, Spike Lee would be the, or Scorsese, one of the two.
Right. I mean, Scorsese's the name that came to me.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't touched it either. I mean, in terms of Gangs in New York, that closing shot was Harvey Weinstein's idea. He's the one that fought for that closing shot at the end of that movie. So, I mean, I don't know. There's still no more 9/11 movies on the horizon. One this year, the holiday season, that's going to be a major Oscar contender. It's called Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close.
Mm-hmm. Great book. I'd be curious to see how that translates to the screen.
Stephen Daldry directed it. It's about a 9-year-old amateur inventor who searches New York for the lock that matches a mysterious key left by his father when he was killed in the September 11th attack.
Right.
It stars Tom Hanks, Sandra Bullock, Viola Davis, John Goodman, James Gandolfini, Max von Sydow, Jeffrey Wright. Hell of a cast. Written by Eric Roth.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be very curious to see how that translates to the screen. I'm very curious.
Shot by Chris Mingez. I mean,
wow.
Yeah.
This is a pedigree.
Can't get
movie.
Any better than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paramount. It actually releases. I guess it would release maybe in two cities on Christmas for Oscar contention.
Yeah.
But it has a release date of.
Score?
It has released. Nico Mulli. It's a composer I know, but I can't tell you what movies he's done. It has a release date of January 20th of next year, but I'm pretty sure, like, the Oscar bait nature of this, it'll come out in a couple of cities in December.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool.
You got such a busy December, though. You got The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and Mission Impossible 4 opening on the same day. So, I mean, I think this December is just, like, booked, like, rock solid. So they're going to do that pedigree, the Oscar thing, I think, for a couple of these.
But yeah,
do you think there's an audience for that movie?
Yeah.
Do you think?
Oh yeah.
No, because his other book was made into a movie, Everything's Illuminated, another great book.
Right.
A very interesting
and that didn't
film.
That didn't start Tom Hanks and Sandra Bullock.
Yeah. I mean, this is going to be a very curious film. I mean, it is the cat. Well, I think I'd be very curious to see how this does. It's a very, very, very fascinating book. So I'd be curious.
There's also the movie. I mean, it's dealing with terrorism and the mindset of terrorism, even though it's domestic terrorism. I mean, one of my favorite movies that I've talked about all the time post 9/11 is the assassination of Richard Nixon, and that really, the thing that moves me about that movie is that it really is a taxi driver for the new age, but in that it shows you what causes someone to snap and become so disillusioned and kind of funnel all of their insecurities and self-hatred and all of that into a twisted kind of cause. And that's what happens to Sean Penn in that movie. And it's a real-life story of a guy that hijacked an airplane and intended to fly it into the White House to kill Richard Nixon. I mean, this really happened in the 70s. And he sent letters to Leonard Bernstein describing his whole plot because he was moved by his music.
Right.
Thought his music represented America and the hope of America that he no longer had in his own life. I mean, he was a loser and he couldn't get ahead. I mean, and in any aspect of his life.
Right.
And all of these and he was kind of ill. And so all of these factors converged and made him a radical, you know?
Right.
I think it's a valuable movie and a very emotional one.
It is.
There was that comedy that came out a few years ago called Four Lions.
I still need
Britain.
To see that. That's supposed to be very good. That got rave reviews.
Yeah, about four newly minted jihadists who are trying to ply their wares and do it very comedically. It is a pretty good movie. Written by the same people who did In the Loop.
Oh yeah.
A few years ago. So
should we talk about Uwe Boll's Postal? probably not.
No,
probably not.
let's leave the dignity in this, please.
yeah. So I'm sure that we'll see, you know, in the books, let's talk about the other media that's reflected 9/11. Books, I mean, I have a few here. 102 Minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the best one, I think.
Yeah.
The Post
yeah.
has a great, today, books about 9/11, the Washington Post, and there's a lot of great stuff, like the aftermath or why, you know, the story behind it, like the looming tower, obviously. There's a lot of them. Imperial Hubris. I mean, they go into great. I mean, there's just, I mean, hundreds of books, and actually some of those are actually very good. But there are two really good narrative books I've read in the last couple of years. The Emperor's Children, which takes place before 9/11, a family, a very well-to-do family in New York. And then there's the Jay McInerney's The Good Life, which is definitely about after 9/11. And then there's another book, I forget the author, I read The Garden of the Last Days, which is actually about the suicide, you know, the pilots, the training, while they're training in Florida, and about their lives. And that's a fascinating novel, just crazy. But there's a lot of great novels that have come out dealing with before and after 9/11.
Music, I mean, I played some of it at the beginning, the Springsteen album,
yeah.
The Rising.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's all about 9/11, the
mm-hmm.
different stories of 9/11, as written by, you know, one of our all-time great songwriters.
Mm-hmm.
And what's fascinating about that album, The Rising, is that it isn't, it's not a downer. I mean, it's not mournful as much as...
it's optimistic.
Yeah, it's optimistic. I don't want to say celebratory.
No, not so, but it is optimistic, though.
Almost that song, The Rising, is almost like a chant, in a way, you know, like a war cry, or I don't know how to put it. It's a very passionate album, and there are songs on that, like Into the Fire, or You're Missing, or Nothing Man, that just slay me. My City of Ruins is probably one of the most popular on that song. Man on Wire, there's also stuff where you watch something like Man on Wire. No mention at all of 9/11, but obviously it's
right.
about a tightrope walker whose ultimate dream when he saw the Twin Towers being constructed was to walk a high wire between those two towers, and he did it. And it plays almost like a thriller because they're trying to sneak in there and go up and hide from the cops and stuff, and this impossible feat. And then he goes up on the wire, and it shows pictures of him in between the two towers, and there's such a sense of peace. And the most moving part of that movie to me is when his girlfriend at the time was watching him from the street below. Everyone
mm-hmm.
was
mm-hmm. Yeah.
gathered there, amazed. And she started to cry, and this was such a cathartic moment. But she knew that their relationship was over at that point. She had been with him through all of his training up to that point,
mm-hmm.
and she knew that things were different now. The chemistry of both of their lives had changed now that he had accomplished the impossible.
Right.
It's a great
mm-hmm.
movie.
Mm-hmm.
I want to
yeah,
see his new
is.
Movie about the monkey, too. But.
Yeah, that didn't, mm-hmm. I didn't
yeah,
play long here. I was hoping.
Project Mem,
yeah.
I wanted to mention two graphic novels that I think are important. There's one called The 9/11 Report, graphic
right.
adaptation by Sid Jacobson and Ernie Colon. And it's an incredibly detailed graphic novel depicting everything that led up to the events of that day. And everything that transpired after it, including all, the 9/11 Commission report, which it's based on. If you were going to do a movie of 9/11, I think you'd really have to take a look at this book
mm-hmm.
as kind of a blueprint as to how to do it. The second book that I'd like to mention is by Art Spiegelman, and it's called In the Shadow of the Towers.
I do have. That's a good one.
Is that the title of it? I think it is.
I'd have to go look for it, but I think you're right.
And that's an incredibly personal story of him, because he lives in the neighborhood, really, and that's the story of he and his wife, Francois Mouly, trying to trying to figure out where their child is during that day, you know, and also going through all of the ash and the rubble, and he does an amazing job of relating this day to a lot of comics that he's known in his past, things like Little Nemo and things like that. That's a fascinating book.
So there's a lot of media out there. It's something that we'll be living with for forever.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we still discuss Pearl Harbor and the JFK assassination.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just one of those dates of infamy that'll last forever.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we close out the show, just real quick, new movies. Contagion?
Mm-hmm. Why don't we talk about Contagion and Warrior?
Also, another movie that might have some, I haven't watched it yet, but might have some 9/11 kind of, feeling kind of connection to it, you know?
It does.
Yeah.
It does.
I loved it. I thought it was really well done. I love the structure of it. I love the ending of it. I mean, I can't reveal how they ended. It's not that it's a surprise ending. It just has to do with the structure of it and how the structure plays into the very end of it. Loved it. The score, it's the best score I've heard all year.
That's a good score. Mm-hmm.
It's completely frightening, as you would expect something like that to be. But it's not. I think it's better than all those other movies like Outbreak and all that kind of stuff. Because
Oh my God! I mean, it's the thinking person's Outbreak, for crying out loud.
But why it is better is because it doesn't play movie-ish. It's a process movie.
It is. That's what Soderbergh does so well.
And that's why the music is great too, because. The music is very surprising, and it's very much like a process. It's methodical. It doesn't amp up the suspense or anything. There's nothing kind of manufactured like that. It just says, what are the possibilities if this happens, and how would these different groups of people go about trying to keep it from spreading, to solve the problem, blah, blah, blah. How would the media raise up the chaos?
Right.
It's a really intelligent exploration. It's very well done, good performances, and an important have stars in the movie for the same reason that those Irwin Winkler movies were important.
Irwin
Winkler.
It's the progressive.
Well, he made his own kind of disaster movie.
It's the liberal progressive Irwin Allen disaster film.
Right. Because they're like bookmarkers, where you can associate a very recognizable face with this thread of this story.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All these different stars in the movie.
Does it have a resemblance to Traffic in that way?
Yes.
Like in terms of
structurally, it does. But it's not as obvious or kind of jarring the style differences between each story thread as Traffic was.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because, you know, the color scheme and everything, like, changed drastically between Stories and Traffic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Not so much here.
Yeah. I can't wait to see it.
Warrior?
Warrior is superb. I thought Warrior was just superb. And I was worried because the trailer, it's a great trailer and everything, but they give away a lot in the trailer. But it in no way impedes on your enjoyment of the film, because of the way that those things are revealed, it's just incredible. And I'm talking about the Tommy's story, is just the way that it comes about, I thought was brilliant. I really was just really moved by it, his part. And I mean, both, but the whole thing is just astoundingly good.
It's a weird cross between the biggest downer of the year and the most kind of jubilant, feel-good movie of the year.
Right. No, you're right.
It's depressing.
It's very bleak. It doesn't have that, like, it's not, I know people were saying, does Lionsgate realize this has Rocky on their hands? Well, it's not exactly Rocky, and it's not exactly The Fighter. There's a lot more going on in this. And that's not to belittle those films at all, and in no way do I mean that. There's just a lot of shit going on. It's a smart movie, though. It's a very strange film.
And in terms of performances, I had never seen the other brother.
I know the name. I know the face. I couldn't tell you what else I've seen him in, though.
I thought he was so wonderful in the movie.
Yeah.
It's such a discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Hardy, I can't get a sense of Tom Hardy. I hear everybody talking about Tom Hardy. Yeah, I don't remember him at all in Inception, but I didn't see the movie that put him on the map. What was that movie?
The Bronson.
Bronson.
I thought Bronson was just so wild and everything, but they're all like these different performances, and I guess next summer he will be a household name.
I'm Bane, sure. After Batman villain, the thing that I think it was a completely brave performance,
mm-hmm.
Tom Hardy in that movie,
because
he didn't play it with an ounce of sentimentality,
mm-hmm. not at all,
and where you could sympathize with the situation of the character, he didn't play it like that at all. I mean, you felt all the way through that movie, this guy is an irredeemable jerk,
mm-hmm.
and it was brave of him, but Nick Nolte is the performance of the year. One of the performances
mm-hmm.
of the year in that movie. Nick Nolte is a revelation. We're so used to in between great roles, which he comes out with every few years or more,
mm-hmm.
we're so used to him being all kinds of crazy. So we forget how truly great he can be, and he is just magnificent in this movie. Powerful movie for him. There's a scene where he's talking to his other son, not Tom Hardy, but the other one,
mm-hmm.
and he's trying to make amends for his past and how he kind of neglected his children and his family, and oh my God, it's like just this sense of pain and loss, and he doesn't have to do anything to express that. It's just there. It's the best performance I've seen this year, supporting or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Go see it, Dean.
Yeah, go see it.
Gotta see both of them this week.
Now, next week I see Tuesday. I see Moneyball.
That looks really good. I'm looking forward to that.
And then Wednesday, I see Straw Dogs. So we have the writer-director of Straw Dogs, who also did The Contender and Last Castle, Nothing But the Truth. He comes on, we'll play his interview on Wednesday night, Rod Laurie. He'll be talking about Straw Dogs.
Former film critic.
Right. And he's been on the show before. He's great.
Mm-hmm.
But this movie is notable because in 1971, when Peckinpah came out with this movie with Dustin Hoffman and Susan George, it really was a firestorm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was controversial to the max for its depiction of violence and rape and all that kind of stuff.
My favorite Dustin Hoffman performance. I think it's by far, like I would say one of his best roles.
It's a very interesting performance.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been talking about it a lot, or it's been covered a lot on the Kubrick series, because it was the precursor to A Clockwork Orange.
Mm-hmm.
And really, in the UK, a lot of reasons why they went after Clockwork Orange like they did was because they felt Straw Dogs had gotten away from them
mm-hmm.
before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Straw Dogs, I think it's best appreciated looking at it as a Western, like most of Peckinpah's movies, even though
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have that setting. You know, it's not like an old West movie or anything.
Well, I guess you could say the same about Convoy, then. I mean, it could be a Western.
Yeah, but really, I mean, it is shaped like a Western.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and he has his last stand against the people at the end, you know, and he mans up. And I think his view of humanity was pretty bleak in that movie, and that it was almost like he got in touch with it. He got in touch with his inner kind of monster, and he fought back. And Laurie's version, I think it's different, in that he gets in touch with who he really is, like the man inside of him,
mm-hmm.
and not like the animal part of him that Peckinpah seemed to think was in all of us and was our natural state.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as pessimistic, but I hear that the depiction of rape and all that kind of stuff, it's still pretty controversial, Rod Laurie's new movie, Incendiary, that movie.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll see what happens. We'll see his take on it. Sweet Home Alabama.
I'm hoping it's a respectful, it looks, part of me thinks it's going to be a really respectful kind of remake, but then when I see how it's being sold, I don't really care for how it's being sold.
Right.
So, But that's the kind of thing that, you know, the filmmaker doesn't have much say.
No, they want people to go see it. So, I mean, and they're competing with, Drive. So it's going to be interesting to see how these two compete next weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It is a tough sell. And the original Straw Dogs was a movie that I've seen it several times. Never quite fully appreciated it. But it's one of Pauline Kael's most famous reviews.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
She claimed it was the first fascist work of art.
That's right.
Yeah, that is right. Mm-hmm.
Peckinpah wrote her a letter defending himself.
That was a nice fascist work of art as well.
Yeah.
They posted that letter. They printed that letter somewhere. I've read that letter that he wrote back to her.
Oh, my. Yeah. Oh, God.
Apparently, Rod Laurie sat with Dustin Hoffman, and he said, you know, I own the rights to Straw Dogs. And Dustin Hoffman got a big smile on his face. This was a couple years ago. And Hoffman said, you got to do it. And he said, the thing to remember about Straw Dogs is it's a Western. So put your own spin on it, and it'll be great. And he was all for it, and that's what convinced Rod Laurie to do it.
Well, that's good. That's got to be very promising to get someone associated with the original film. I mean, that's got to be. That's wonderful. I didn't know that. That's a great.
You can't really. I mean, they're polar opposites. Peckinpah and Rod Laurie.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. You know, one of the most interesting things about Peckinpah was, you know, towards the end there, he was doing second unit work, begging for second unit work on, and he got it on Jinxed, and he did such a good job that's I think how that led to not Convoy but the Osterman Weekend, and well, that didn't really turn out so great. That was really, I mean, I'm all for directors trying out new things, but Peckinpah, I don't think, I mean, doing a very odd Robert Ludlum novel, very confusing one at that.
Very.
Yeah, I mean, the movie makes no sense. He was aware of it while filming it. He told his editors, he brought the reels, like, if you can make sense of this, more power to you. I have no idea what I've just done.
Well, you know, and if I weren't so afraid, I would have asked Rutger Hauer about that movie.
Oh,
when
God.
We had him on.
He probably wanted to forget that, too.
I was so fearful by that time.
I know, really. He's afraid he's going to get on a plane and kill us.
And then I got some Blu-rays in. I got the new Criterion. I got Robert Altman's Three Women.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
That's a good movie. That is so great. Have you ever watched that?
It's a good one.
Not until yesterday, no.
Ah, what a great movie that is. I just, every time I watch that movie, I'm just astounded at how good it is.
It's odd. It's a weird one.
It's basic. The first half of that movie, Sissy Spacek is so funny in that movie, you know. She's so hilarious. Then when she changes over, you know, it's just, you just like, oh, I miss the old girl, you know. And then there's just so much that's really funny in it. Shelley Duvall trying to invite all those guys around the pool over, and they're barely even paying attention, and heard them trying to make up that party for them and everything, but then it just gets so disturbing, so ridiculously disturbing in its last half. It's like two halves of two different movies that are stuck together somehow, but it's just brilliant. I just love it. One of his great.
It's an odd one. I'm going to have to struggle with that movie for a while, I think. I also listened to Altman's commentary on it, too.
Well, you know, it's part of a trilogy of his movies that were like dream movies, the movies that were inspired by something that he had dreamt, along with, I'm not exactly sure what the third one is, but the first one is Images, that came out in 1970 with Susanna York as a woman that's kind of going crazy. You know, you really get that sense of, it's really a kind of a great dream movie, because you do get a sense of it kind of coming from some other place.
Right.
Yeah. You
know, oh, it does. Place. It does. Yeah. I love Altman. before we close out, I want to let our listeners know, if you buy film books, we have a special deal for you guys. If you go to our media page, moviegeeksunited.net/media, where you'll see all the Blu-rays, soundtracks, and books that we discussed during the shows. You'll see a special offer from Hal Leonard Publications. They publish a lot of stuff on theater and film. And if you enter a special code that you can find on our website, they will give you 20% off plus free shipping on any books in their Applause series or their Limelight Edition series. So they have a great selection of film books, so you should take advantage of that if you're wanting to buy them. Mm-hmm. All right, Dean, you had an idea for a closing song for tonight's show. Explain your idea.
I just think that this song, just says it all. It seems so prescient, it almost knew what was going to happen or whatever. It's all, of course, hindsight 2020 and everything. But it came out in 1975 by Paul Simon, who obviously today during the ceremonies this morning did Sounds of Silence. But
yeah.
I think that this is even a better song to close out the show about 9/11 because its lyrics just really have a sense of hope and a sense of also a sense of dire kind of desperation to it, and then the final lines to it just blow you away, and it's called American Tune, and I just think it's a great song. And
I know the song well, and I've heard more than one songwriter say that this is the greatest pop song ever written. This is held in high esteem. So I'm playing the song you recommended, but as you can probably guess, I'm compromising a little bit.
Right.
or you have to compromise a little bit, because I'm playing the version that I love, which is the Willie Nelson version.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay?
Sounds good.
Okay, so we're both winners.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you don't like Willie Nelson out there,
I wanted to say one other thing. Today, I learned this through the Saint of 9/11 documentary, because they're playing some radio, what was playing on the radio before everything happened on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And the radio announcer said that today is Brian De Palma's birthday.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Today is his birthday. I know a lot of people who think this today.
Yeah, so I just thought I'd throw that out there. I thought you'd want to say happy birthday to Brian De Palma.
I was actually going to say that.
Happy birthday, Brian.
Yeah, happy birthday, Brian.
Okay. Here is Willie Nelson, American Tune, written by Paul Simon. Paul Simon plays and produces this version of Willie's song. If you don't like Willie Nelson, today's about tolerance, so you'll have to live with it. All right, guys. I'll see you guys on Wednesday night. Thanks for joining.
Take care, everyone.
All right. See you later.
Bye, everybody.
Many's the time I've been mistaken. Many times confused, yes, and I've often felt forsaken and certainly misused. Oh, but I'm all right, I'm all right, just weary to my bones. Still, you don't expect to be bright and bon vivant so far away from home, so far away from home. I don't know a soul who's not been battered, don't have a friend who feels at ease, don't know a dream that's not been shattered or driven to its knees. Oh, but it's all right, it's all right, for we've lived so well so long. Still, when I can't help it, I wonder what's gone wrong. I dreamed I was dying. I dreamed that my soul rose unexpectedly, looking back down at me, smiled reassuredly. I dreamed I was flying high up above. My eyes could clearly see the Statue of Liberty sailing away to sea. I dreamed I was flying. But we come on the ship they call the Mayflower. We come on the ship that sails the moon. We come in the age's most uncertain hours and sing an American tune. Oh, but it's all right. It's all right. Can't be forever blessed. Still, tomorrow's gonna be another working day, and I'm trying to get some rest. That's all, I'm trying to get some rest.